It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Neil Conan is away. I'm Guy Raz. Former presidential candidate John Edwards wants to cut poverty in America by half over the next 10 years. But can he do it without a national political platform? John Edwards is our guest this hour. Did you vote for him, and why? And are the issues he raised still being addressed? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. John Edwards, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I want to begin by asking you about Senator Jesse Helms, of course, who died this past week. How do you assess his legacy?
Complicated. He was, in so many ways, represented the opposite of what I believe and what I think the country needed and needs today. There was a point at which when we both served in the Senate from North Carolina, we were identified as the state with the U.S. senators who had the most diametrically opposed voting records. So we obviously had huge, huge differences on big issues. Having said that, he could be very kind and generous in a personal way, and I saw that myself and my own family.
Mm-hmm. So a complicated legacy, of course.
Yeah, no doubt complicated. Certainly doesn't represent what I think America needs.
Yesterday, Senator Edwards, Virginia Senator Jim Webb ruled out accepting an offer to run on the Democratic ticket with Barack Obama. Now, it's an open secret that you are on the short list. If you were asked, would you accept your party's vice presidential nomination?
I'm glad to hear that's an open secret because I didn't know it. My answer to that is I've run for vice president. I've run for president twice. I would do anything that I felt I could do to serve this country. But I think it's a huge presumption for me or anybody else to suggest what Senator Obama may decide. To answer your question directly, I don't expect to be asked. I have no expectation about it at all. I will anything that Senator Obama asked me to do, including this, including campaigning for him, I intend to do because I intend to take seriously because mm-hmm. what I intend to do is everything in my power to make sure that he's the next president.
So you are prepared perhaps to accept that or perhaps a cabinet position in a possible Obama administration?
I'm prepared to seriously consider anything he asked me to do for our country.
John Edwards, when you dropped out of the presidential race in January, you said, and I quote, "It's hard to speak out for change when you feel like your voice is not being heard." Now, you are trying to raise the profile of poverty in America. Can you do that, being out of government?
Oh, sure you can. I don't want to use him as an example for me because he's risen to such lofty heights, but Al Gore is a wonderful example of what's possible when you're not in government. I mean, here's a man who believed deeply in a cause, doing something about climate change. He was not in government. He's won the Academy Award, the Nobel Prize, and is the voice, the most powerful voice in the world today on doing something about climate change. So I think he's a living, breathing example for what's possible, you know, that whether I could ever get to that place in trying to do something about poverty, both in America and globally, would be extremely hard thing for me to do. But what's more important than me and my voice is making sure we actually address this huge moral issue.
Our guest is former senator and presidential candidate, John Edwards. He's in the studio with us here. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address, talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Did you vote for John Edwards and why? And what was it about his ideas that appealed to you? And do you find that the candidates are now addressing some of those ideas? John Edwards, how do you keep the issues you care deeply about, health care, for example, poverty, obviously, economic inequality, how do you keep that on the radar screen of someone like Barack Obama during the campaign?
Well, you know, I'm lucky and blessed that I do have a national voice. People generally know who I am from my presidential campaigns and my vice presidential run. And so the result of that, I can usually get heard on shows like yours. And so I have a platform that allows me to speak to the country about these issues. As specifically as to Senator Obama, I've talked to him many times now about the economic inequality, about doing something about poverty in America, doing something about poverty globally. And the last thing he needs from me is for me to talk to him about this. He already knows it. He knows what a big issue it is. He cares about it deeply. He has his entire life, starting with his community organizing in Chicago. So what I want to do is make sure that I continue to be out there fighting every day with every fiber of my being for what is the cause, central cause of my life, which is doing something about this inequality and economic justice.
Senator Edwards, what do you think it was that Barack Obama managed to tap into that you simply couldn't connect with?
We both believe deeply in change. I think it was central to both our campaigns. I think that he was able to stir young people in a way that others did not. I think he was able to speak to a group of Americans who had not voted, not just young people, but Americans who had not voted in a long period of time and who were generally cynical about politics. And I think convinced people that the system is broken and it needs to be fixed and made to work for everybody. And he had an enormous amount of passion and energy around his campaign as a result.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've recently taken over a program that intends to cut poverty by half over the next 10 years. That's a pretty lofty goal. How do you expect to do that?
Well, it's called the Half in 10 campaign. Anybody who's interested in helping us with it can go to halfin10.org and join this campaign, you and your friends. We're looking for grassroots support, looking for all the help we can get in this effort. So that's part of the answer to your question. We need to mobilize and energize both Americans who are interested in this issue. Secondly, all the extraordinary group of organizations who've been working on this for decades, who care deeply about it, grassroots organizations, religious organizations, all kinds of groups who care about this issue. And then we have to motivate politicians to do something about this. One of the commitments I got from Senator Obama withdrew from the race was a commitment to make poverty central to his campaign and central to his presidency, the ending of poverty, central to his campaign and his presidency, to spend time campaigning on this issue in the general election, and to do some other very specific things. So I think you put pressure on political leaders and you motivate the country.
Why do you think that poverty isn't the kind of sexy political issue like immigration, for example, or the economy? It doesn't seem to resonate with voters in the same way as those other issues.
Well, I don't accept that. I understand the theory, but I don't accept it. If you watch the way Americans responded to the hurricane hitting New Orleans, for example, and the extraordinary poverty that we saw in the Ninth Ward, as a result, the American people responded incredibly. The government didn't, but the people did, with volunteering, with contributing, taking families into their homes and into their communities. I don't think that's an accident. But I think we have a history here. It's been 40 years since we've had a serious, sustained effort to end poverty in this country. And a lot of good things have been done, and we need to recognize those good things. And there were a number of mistakes made. And we need to recognize those mistakes. So the starting place, I think there is deeply embedded within the American people a goodness and a will among most Americans to do something about this. What we have to do is motivate them. There needs to be sustained national leadership. And third, there have to be a set of policy proposals, simple things like raising the minimum wage, expansion of the earned income tax credit, making quality child care available, strengthening the right of unions to organize, a whole group of things that will help lift people out of poverty that makes sense to folks.
Okay, let's take a caller now. John is on the line with us from Chicago. John, welcome to the show.
Hello?
Hi, John. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I had the pleasure of working for Senator Edwards out in Iowa. Drove out from Chicago and spent a couple of days, met the senator twice. I'm a teacher, and I'm a powerful supporter of unions. And I think that's the way to tackle poverty, the first and foremost way to tackle poverty. And I'm a little concerned about both Hillary Clinton and Senator Obama's commitment to strong unions and scrutinizing these free trade unions. I know Mark Penn had clients down in Latin America that was a conflict of interest for him, and I seem to recall Obama's people were strategizing with some Canadian folks about their take on some of these agreements, and I want to know how Senator Edwards is going to make sure that these strong union planks are in the platform. I need him as someone who voted for him. I want him fighting, and I want to know how the teeth are going to be in there.
John Edwards?
Well, first of all, I don't think there's a lot of work to do with Senator Obama on this issue. He cares as deeply about this as I do. He's committed. If you listen to him, his language is very similar to mine about the problems with our trade policy over the last decade plus. He understands it. He understands what needs to change about the way we engage the rest of the world on trade. He understands the loss of American jobs. He's seen it up close. In fact, he tells the story about some of his original organizing in Chicago being the result of factories closing in Chicago and people losing their jobs. So I think this is something he takes very personally. And I think the issue of organizing, he's been involved in union organizing campaigns in his life before he was ever a politician. So I intend to continue to speak out on these causes because they're deep and personal to me. And I think that if you look at the history, the arc of economic inequality in America, one of the most powerful anti-poverty movements is the union movement, the organized labor movement. So I think it's central to being successful. We do need a president who explains to America the importance of union organizing, not just for the unions, but for all of us, because it strengthens the middle class, it grows the middle class, it lifts people out of poverty, and that strengthening and growing of the middle class creates the kind of broad foundation that allows for long-term sustainable economic growth.
John, thanks so much for the call. Later on in the program, we're going to read from your letters, and we're going to talk to a man who's trying to put a smiley face on the oil and gas industry. But more with Senator John Edwards in a moment, and we're going to be taking your calls at 800-989-8255. You can also send us email. Our email address is talk@npr.org. I'm Guy Raz. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Guy Raz here in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by the man who has perhaps the toughest job in Washington, the public face of the oil and gas industry, and he's about to take that job up in the fall. Right now, John Edwards is our guest, the former Democratic senator from North Carolina and candidate for president, just announced a new campaign to cut poverty in half over the next 10 years. We're talking about his plan, about presidential politics, and about life after the campaigns. If you have questions for John Edwards about his future in and out of politics, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Again, 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And John Edwards, I want to ask you to be a political consultant for a moment, a strategist, if you will. In 2004, white males voted for the Bush-Cheney ticket by a margin of 25 percentage points over Kerry Edwards. Now, since 1960, the Democratic Party's share of white male voters has dropped steadily. Do the Democrats have a white male voter problem?
No. What we have is a responsibility to, particularly in this environment, with all the economic struggles that all Americans are going through, including white males, white male workers in America, to make the case about these guys, the Republicans, having a long time to be able to do the things they wanted to do and that they're not working. They've been a disaster. And I think we have a powerful opportunity available to us to reverse this trend that you're describing. And I think we just need to grasp that opportunity.
And you lost, of course, in your home state of North Carolina in 2004. Do you think that state is in play this year for Barack Obama?
I know it is. Mm-hmm. I think that it's still a tough fight, but I think Virginia is totally winnable. We're thinking about the states just south of D.C. Virginia is totally winnable. North Carolina is a state where we could clearly win for a variety of reasons, because, you know, we've had huge population growth, particularly in the Research Triangle, which is a heavy Democratic stronghold. I think there'll be a large turnout of African American voters, as was exhibited in the Democratic primary in North Carolina by Senator Obama in his campaign. So I think there's a huge opportunity available to us in North Carolina. Yeah, I think we could win.
Tanya is on the line with us from Sacramento, California. Tanya, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I voted for John Edwards, and I'm a social worker, and right now I've been working with kids in foster care for the last 7-8 years. And I know that you have this organization, and I'm wondering if, you know, we're here in California, they're talking about cutting Medi-Cal, which is like Medicaid for the rest of the country, this coming budget, and I'm wondering if your organization's involved in this. I'm also concerned about how much energy or how much emphasis do you really think Obama's going to put on the concern of the poor. I see foster kids also as being part of the poor. They get leftovers in so many ways, and this is another cut that's going to affect trying to find medical services for these kids. And there's so many other things that they don't, you know, that they get the leftovers. And I'm just wondering if your organization has any impact on that and what's going on here in California, and if you see Obama and his campaign working towards fighting things like this.
Well, let me say, first of all, thank you for your support and your vote, because by the time of the California primary, I'd already withdrawn from the race, so that means you were truly committed.
I know, but I wanted to vote anyway.
Bless you. Thank you for that. It's a huge mistake for us to be cutting funding from Medicaid, Medi-Cal as it is in California, for a whole variety of reasons. I mean, we have all these kids out there who need access to decent health care, and in many cases, Medicaid is the only vehicle available for that health care. And what you see happening is, in times of economic stress on state budgets and on the federal budget, you see this social safety net being cut at the time that it's most needed. And our responsibility as a country is to ensure that we don't, in times of stress, take away the very tools that allow people to survive. And so as to Senator Obama, I've talked in great depth with him about this. I really mean it. I hope people will hear what I'm saying, particularly people who supported me. This guy does not have to be pushed by me. He cares deeply about these issues. He and I will be working in tandem to speak to the American people about this, because he cares about it, and he will lead on it, and he's shown his leadership over the entire his entire life. So I see my role in this and my responsibility is to continue to lead the movement against economic inequality, whether it's single moms, foster children, all the groups who are struggling in this country, and to be their voice, because they don't have a voice if we don't have somebody speaking for them at the national level. And I think we actually are blessed in this time in 2008. I'm lucky to get the opportunity to be able to be heard around the country about this issue. Senator Obama will continue to speak out on these economic inequality issues. I think we have a wonderful, wonderful opportunity, and I am convinced that when, not if, Barack Obama is elected president, that you're going to see the first serious effort to do something about the economically disadvantaged in America in the last 40 years.
Tana, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
I want to read an email written to you, Senator Edwards, from Beth in Charlotte, North Carolina. She writes, "I'm from North Carolina and familiar with you and how you made your millions. My husband is a doctor who was born when his parents lived in a garage, also made it out of poverty by hard work. How do you plan to eliminate poverty without wealth distribution, taxing those who worked hard to get where they are and don't shelter income and end up losing almost half of our income to taxes? Where is the responsibility of the poor to take advantage of things like free education?"
Well, it sounds like I just might have a fundamental disagreement with her. Let me start with simple things. I come from the background that she's describing for her husband. You know, my family didn't have anything. My father, as everyone knows, worked, because I said it every time I gave a speech for 5 years, was a mill worker and didn't get a chance to go to college. And I'm very proud of my father. And I've been able to be incredibly successful in America. But that's because the opportunities of America were available to me. And what's happened is we've had a whole set of public policy ideas, including our tax system, that have greatly advantaged those who need the advantages the least. Listen, I'm not against people doing well in America. I'm totally for it. You know, otherwise I'd be against myself. What her husband has done, he deserves to be applauded for. People who've worked hard and been extremely successful, we should lift them up and use them as examples for our kids and for those who are trying to attain the same level of success. But what I want to do is I want to see some of these barriers knocked down, whether it's access to college, access to quality health care, access to decent housing, all those things. And I don't think we need to continue to have continuation or new tax cuts for people who are the strongest financially, the richest people in the country. I think instead what we ought to do is give up. When I talk about earlier, I talked about, it sounds a little wonky, but expansion of the earned income tax credit. Basically, that's a refundable tax credit for people who work full-time, who are working for a living.
But how do you do that, John Edwards, as a private citizen? I mean, how do you do that? You're not in the Senate. You're not introducing legislation. I mean, how can you practically make that happen?
By getting out and fighting with my heart and soul for it and speaking out on shows like yours, so that millions of people hear how important this is. They understand that somebody cares about it. They understand that in this presidential election, Barack Obama cares about it, so the election matters. I mean, it's a combination of mobilizing grassroots efforts, touching the soul of America about something that is a deep moral issue that exists in this country.
But you have been out of government now for 4 years. Yes. If you do not accept a position, if Barack Obama is elected president and you do not accept a position either in his cabinet or as his vice president, you'll be out of government for another 4 years. Mm-hmm. Won't that be a disadvantage to you?
Well, I guess you could ask – I would ask the question, Al Gore's been out of government for 8 years, and what effect has he had on what's happening on climate change and global warming? And I think it depends on how deeply you're committed to it. I mean, I know his heart and soul and every fiber of his being is in this issue. I'm in exactly the same place when it comes to poverty, both in America and globally. And I absolutely believe if you're committed to it, if you're lucky enough, and I am lucky, to be able to be in a position to be heard, that you can put pressure on political leaders, number one, and number two, you can actually help educate the American people who can also get engaged and put pressure on political leaders. This is how you bring about change.
David is on the line with us from Kenosha, Wisconsin. David, welcome.
Hi, how are you? Senator Edwards, one of the things that concerns me is Barack Obama is trying to forward President Bush's faith-based programs. I'm concerned with that because I haven't really seen that much effort, and I don't really see a whole lot of specifics in his program. And I just look at the government as not being the solution. I agree with the faith-based thing, but how do we get the corporations that manufacture food in this country to start providing more and more to our food pantries and to our church-based organizations so that the poverty, the poor people can actually access that food and, at least be well-fed, and that goes a long way towards the rest of what you've been talking about.
Honestly, I had a little trouble following some of that. I think that if I understand what you're asking, I couldn't tell if you were against or for Senator Obama's faith-based proposal.
I'm for it. I just want to hear more specifics.
Okay, I got you. If you're me and you're, as I have been for the last several years, including before I was running for president in 2008, if you've been traveling all over the country and going to, literally hundreds of places where effort is being made to help poor families, an enormous part of that effort is being executed by faith-based groups. And the reality of it is, and I think this is what Barack is saying, the reality of it is that that is the mechanism by which much of the work is being done to help poor families and to get them food, decent place to live, to help them find good employment, et cetera. Now, there is a natural uneasiness, particularly among Democrats, but I think among a lot of Americans, about the separation of church and state and the danger of crossing that line in this area. What you the only thing I would say to everyone in America is understand there are two polar opposites in George Bush and Barack Obama. Barack Obama is trying to help people, and he will never permit, and you can take this to the bank, he will never permit those lines to be crossed. He will now never allow any recipient, and he said this in his speech, any recipient of federal money to discriminate, to in any way punish those who are of a different faith belief. He understands very well the Constitution of the United States, the bedrock of this democracy, and the critical importance of separation of church and state.
Thank you, David, for the call. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Senator Edwards, you put yourself out there as a presidential candidate. You put your family out there. You expose your entire life to the media. You're followed around 24 hours, 7 days a week. And then it evaporates. How do you cope with that on a personal level? What's that like?
Well, it's a big change. I mean, it's, you know, I went from having several hundred people working for me in the campaign to having just a very small number who are helping us day to day. And we continue to get, you know, hundreds of requests constantly to come speak at this or help with this organization, et cetera. Let me just put this in simple terms. It is a dramatic change.
Is it hard to deal with?
No question about that. It's just, is it hard to deal with? It's something you have to adjust to. But it's not as dramatic as some of the other things that I've been through in my life.
Yeah.
As most people know, we lost a child 12 years ago. Elizabeth and I did. Elizabeth's been diagnosed with breast cancer, or her cancer came back.
And she'll be on the show tomorrow.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's terrific. In any event, I've had some much more important things happen in my life than my not being successful in a political campaign.
Mm-hmm. Let's get one more call before we wrap up. Robert is on the line with us from Germany, from a military base there. Welcome, Robert.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Mr. Edwards, if you allow me to change the topic rather quick. As an influential person, and I know you have constant contact with Senator Obama, I'm over here supporting the community I work in with, supporting the war effort. However, when I just recently went back to the U.S., I feel that many people are very disconnected with actually what's going on. And one of the thoughts I had is what affects people most in America is their paycheck. And I was concerned that if Senator Obama was to continue this war, or he's trying to put an end to it, I think American people would be more connected if they saw a payroll deduction directly proportional to what's going on in Afghanistan and Iraq, where I think people would be their eyes would be open as they saw their their payroll deductions increase because of what's going on. I feel like only a few percentile of our population is actually paying the high price for what's going on in both Afghanistan and Iraq, and I'd like to take your comments off the air.
Thanks, Robert, for that call. And Senator Edwards, in the brief moments we have remaining, can you respond to that?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting idea. I actually believe, though, that that most Americans understand the extraordinarily important difference between Senator McCain and Senator Obama on the war. You know, Senator McCain will continue the war. He said maybe have American troops there for up to 100 years. Senator Obama will end this war. I think he'll do it in a responsible way. And I think most Americans already understand that there's a direct connection between extraordinary amounts of money that are being spent on this war every single day, and even more importantly, the lives that are being lost and put at risk, and what needs to be done here in America and other parts of the world. I mean, it's very hard to have universal health care to address these issues, these economic issues that exist at home with things like the mortgage crisis, when we're continuing to pour hundreds of billions of dollars into this war in Iraq. Mm-hmm. The war needs to be ended.
John Edwards is a former senator from North Carolina and, of course, candidate for the Democratic nomination for president. He's now the national chair of Half in 10, From Poverty to Prosperity. And he joined us from the studios at member station WETA in Arlington, Virginia. John Edwards, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, putting the best face on the oil and gas industry, I'm Guy Raz. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now, when it comes to tough jobs in Washington, this one has to be near the top, serving as the face of the oil and gas industry. As the Washington Post put it, Jack Girard is about to become the most hated man in Washington. An exaggeration, maybe, but with the $4 and $5 gallon of gas right now, selling Americans and Congress on the oil business is going to take some work and a thick skin. Then again, you could say the same thing about representing the mining business or the chemical industry. And Jack Girard has worked for both of those. Right now, he's the head of the American Chemistry Council, and in the next few weeks, he takes over at the American Petroleum Institute as its next president. He is here with us in Studio 3A. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Guy. It's good to be with you.
Do you ever feel like you are living in a Christopher Buckley novel, that famous book and film, Thank You for Smoking?
No, not at all. I've represented some great industries in this country. In my view, the three pillars that make us successful and the envy of the world.
How do you decide to get your message out? I mean, aren't you going to be accused by some people of trying to put lipstick on a pig?
Well, in this particular challenge at hand, the issues being asked by the public generally are very legitimate and, frankly, in my view, welcome. We need to have a robust debate in this country about energy, how we use energy, how we conserve energy, how we become more energy efficient. And equally important, what we do as we look to the future to have adequate supplies of oil and natural gas to fuel this vast economy.
We want to open the phone lines to you, our listeners. This is your chance to talk with the future president of the American Petroleum Institute. Where do you think America should get its oil and gas? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Jack Girard, this is not just an unpopular industry. I'm not making that up. People are furious. How do you reach the average American who spends more than ever now to fill their tank of gas while oil companies are recording record profits? I mean, whether it's fair or not, they're blaming the industry that you're about to represent.
Well, I think the importance here, Guy, and I think you've hit the important question here. We've clearly focused the public's attention is now on this question of energy. Energy comes in various forms. It's used in various ways. This debate, in our view, is a healthy debate because we're going to get away from polarized debates of 30 years ago, in which it was kind of a drill, no drill discussion. And we're now finally focused on what are the real issues surrounding this energy debate? Why is gas over $4 a gallon? Why has the price of natural gas risen 460% in the last 7 years? We in the business of chemistry, the business I currently work in, we've lost over 120,000 jobs in the last 6 to 7 years. Why? Because the price of natural gas, which is determined by the supply here in the United States, has risen 460%. Yet for 30 years, we have placed off limits 85% of the outer continental shelf where we have vast natural gas reserves. This debate is a healthy debate. As we stick to the facts, we can better understand what it's going to take to be competitive, to allow Americans to prosper with American energy. And so that part of it will be healthy, I believe, as we develop public policy surrounding the issue of energy.
There's been some speculation that you were brought on board, in a sense, to improve the image of the industry, particularly now when people are paying such high prices for gas.
Well, the individual that's been running the association for the last 11 years, Red Cavan, he's an outstanding individual. He came to the point of retirement, and that's what generated the change, if you will, at the American Petroleum Institute. But more importantly, regardless of who heads the institute, to me, what's great about this great country is we're all allowed to have our own opinions, but we're not allowed to have our own facts. And so we think if we have a robust debate centered on the facts, the public will become better educated, will have a great discourse, and hopefully out of that will come up with good public policy by Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and all others.
Leslie is online with us from Cody, Wyoming. Leslie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I appreciate your taking my phone call. I have a couple questions, comments. Being out here in Wyoming where we have all sorts of energy and whatnot, One of the things that I've heard is that we have some of the largest reserves in the world, in like Colorado and Montana. And along that same line, I understand that we've had no refineries built in this country since like 1963, at which point I'm kind of wondering why we have to be so dependent upon foreign oil for our gasoline and whatnot.
Jack Girard, I mean, why do we have to be so dependent on foreign oil?
Well, I think the answer, Guy, and Leslie, thanks for the question, is we don't have to be. And I think that's what's really part and parcel to the center of this current debate. You look at the great state of Wyoming, which is a very significant coal producer. Today, over 50% of our electricity in the United States comes from coal-fired power. Yet oftentimes we don't know that. We are having a climate change debate in this country right now. Coal is our number one source of electricity, and some people just immediately dismiss it and say, let's not use coal. But if we use this vast reserve of coal, which we have, some have often said the United States is the Saudi Arabia of coal. It's much more significant than that. The BTU capability of the coal in the United States is equal to the entire world oil reserve. So when we look at the resources that we're currently sitting on, that in many instances we're not allowed to develop, we can become less dependent on foreign sources. We have natural gas supplies in this country, which really dictate the terms of our natural gas for industries like ours who use it to create everyday products. If we were able to use those American resources for Americans, we would become far less dependent on foreign sources.
But of course, Jack Girard, there are consequences to using so much coal. I mean, obviously, its impact on the environment, for one.
The key to that, though, Guy...
So what prevents us from using it now? And don't we have technology where we can produce it without impacting our environment so severely?
Jack?
Well, Leslie, let me respond to that. And the answer to both questions is yes. Let me further explain that. Coal right now, we're working on carbon sequestration technologies, which would allow you to use coal in such a way that we capture the carbon as it leaves the facilities, the same way that we've captured NOx, SO2, and mercury in the past. So we do have that capability, but the technologies aren't fully developed yet. So we believe the best solution to our energy policy is to say we are going to use this vast coal reserve. We're going to develop modern-day technologies to capture these potential pollutants, and at the same time, we can use this vast energy resource. So, Leslie, the answer is yes, we can use these energy resources. We can protect the environment at the same time. We just have to have the political will to move from the two polar opposites, move to the center, and allow technology to take us to that next generation.
Leslie, so thanks so much for the call.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Leslie.
And let's go to Stephanie now. Stephanie in Iron City, Georgia. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about where the natural gas or oil that's pumped out of the Gulf of Mexico, where will it actually be sold? Will it be sold to U.S. refineries, or does it go out onto a world market?
Well, there's a very important distinction here, and that's a great question, because while oil is traded in a world market and the price is set at a global level, if you will, natural gas is the pricing is established more on a regional basis. So the amount of gas that we produce in the United States, in Canada, Mexico, and elsewhere that really feeds the U.S. economy is really what will dictate the longer-term price of natural gas. So most of what's generated in the outer continental shelf, particularly in the Gulf of Mexico today, comes ashore in the United States and the vast majority used in the United States. As I mentioned earlier, unfortunately, 85% of our outer continental shelf, or these are the deep waters, miles off the shores of the United States, 85% of that is not available for development today. If we open that up and bring more supply to the marketplace, we believe the price of natural gas will come down closer to historic levels.
But is the trade-off, and Stephanie, thanks so much for the call, but is there a trade-off as well? I mean, you open that up and obviously you make yourself more vulnerable to environmental destruction.
Well, Guy, let's think about that comment. And that's one of the great myths of 30 years ago in the 30-year-old debate. When we look at what's going on around the globe today, the United States is the only industrialized nation that does not develop those outer continental shelf resources. Europe oftentimes has a reputation of being far more sensitive to their environment, being far greener, if you will, than the United States. Yet they continue to develop their resources off their coast 20 miles out. We're talking 50 miles and beyond here in the United States. What is the risk? There was an unfortunate spill in the late 60s off the California coast. Since then, we have had no significant spills. When we look at the unfortunate events in the Gulf of Mexico, the storms of Katrina and Rita, they actually blew some of these oil and gas platforms right off their moorings, yet we had no reports of significant spills. Why? Because the technology is significantly better today than it's ever been. The risk to environmental harm is so small that we should be far more aggressive in protecting American lives and jobs with American resources and quit requiring the heavy dependence upon foreign sources.
I want to read an email from Bruce. Bruce writes in asking, there are commercials running now by the industry that you're about to take over, the petroleum industry. It states that most of the oil and energy is coming from North America. Most of the oil and energy we use comes from North America. If that is the case, why does OPEC set the price?
Well, it's let me step back and answer that more broadly, if I can, on a global basis. Bruce, to your question, we produce a fair amount of oil and natural gas in the United States. When you look at it on a global level, likewise, particularly the Middle Eastern nations produce vast amounts of oil and natural gas. One thing a lot of people aren't aware of, if you look at the 10 greatest reserve holders of oil and natural gas in the world, none of those are American companies or American interest. They're foreign governments. The amount of reserve controlled and held by U.S. producers is about 8% in the global economy. So in oft times, unfortunately, in some of these political debates, everybody looks for a villain. They all want to point a finger, and they point to different companies or different reasons why they believe we have a problem. The fundamental problem is supply and demand. The Chinese demand has gone up dramatically. Indian demand has gone up. And we have the ability in this country to mitigate those concerns.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Nona is on the line with us from Cincinnati, Ohio. Nona, welcome.
Welcome to your guest, and thank you very much for taking my call. Very quickly, here in America, there are so many companies that rely on gasoline fuel for their small businesses to get them to and from work, not to mention the truck drivers. We have heard in the past that one of the conglomerates in the oil companies have made over $400 billion in profits. My question is, why can't the gasoline go down from $4 to $2 and they make $200 billion in profits and allow these small businesses, as myself, that are working in an area where we use gasoline every day for 8 or 9 hours so that we can continue to work, but the gas company would make $200 billion in profits?
And fair question. Fair question, Nona. What, Jack Girard?
Well, Nona, thanks for your question. Your numbers are excessively high, but that's okay. Let's go to the fundamental heart of the issue that you've raised. And we don't disagree with the concern that's out there today. As I mentioned earlier, the price of oil and gas is set on a global basis. There are a lot of factors in play today that will dictate the ultimate outcome. As I mentioned earlier, the best thing for the United States to do is deal with the issues that we can deal with. In this case, bringing additional supply in the marketplace, learning to use energy in a more efficient way and to conserve more energy. I come from a small rural background. My father was a John Deere dealer out in southeastern Idaho, and I grew up driving a small delivery truck. I understand what that does. I just spent last week with him to get a chance to visit with a grandpa with the kids for a while. I know what impact that has on local economies, on local families. The challenge for us today is a question of public policy. Are we going to continue to allow these global factors, this great demand in China, this demand in India and others, to continue to drive up this price because the supply has been limited and demand continues to rise? Or are we going to have the political courage in this country to step forward and develop a policy that says we will use our resources to mitigate those impacts for average Americans, for all the rest of us, so we can compete in this global economy?
Nona, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you so very much.
Jack Girard, will your industry, the American Petroleum Institute, the oil and gas industry, will you try to get Americans to use less?
Well, I think it's important, Guy, that overall, when we look at an energy policy in the United States, it has to be comprehensive. There is not a silver bullet here to answer the broader question. So to your point, absolutely, we need to be more energy efficient in what we do. We need to conserve more. We need to find alternative forms of energy. And you see many of the folks in the oil and gas business investing heavily in these areas. We need to look at wind. We need to look at renewables. We need to look at more capacity to generate electricity from coal-fired power in a clean way, from nuclear energy, and the list goes on and on. So at the end of the day, this isn't about one particular form of energy over another. We have a vast economy. We have to compete in a global economy. So we need to look at every solution and to develop a comprehensive approach and get away from this pointing fingers at each other. We need to get away from partisan bickering, trying to gain political advantage, and say, what's in the best interest of Americans, and what can we do with American resources to protect the interests of our people?
Jack Girard is currently the president and CEO of the American Chemistry Council. This fall, he takes over as a new president of the American Petroleum Institute, representing the oil and gas industry. Jack Girard, thanks for coming in, and good luck.
Thank you, Guy. Appreciate it.
Coming up, how old is too old to be the president? You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.